then roared out to sea, where it threw great clouds of spume across the roads and tore away the masts of two whalers. During its destructive passage, the whistling increased to an intense shriek and then subsided. Under the protection of a clump of cocoa trees, Janders asked, "Where's the rain?" None came, but the wind howled down from the mountains in new gusts, knocking down trees and throwing pigs into ditches. From the little stream before the mission house, it picked up water, flinging it upon the trees, then passed out to sea, where it dashed three moored whalers together, staving in the sides of one and leaving it in perilous condition. Still no rain came, but the winds increased, rising to even more furious levels than before. And now it became evident why the Hawaiians had left their homes, for one after another the little huts went flying through the air, crashing into the first solid object that intervened. "Will these trees hold?" Abner asked anxiously. But before anyone could assure him, he saw a dark object hurtling through the air and cried, "The church!" "It's the roof," Whipple shouted, astonished at what he saw. "It's the entire roof." Majestically, the roof sailed over the town of Lahaina and plunged into the sea. "The walls are going down," Whipple cried, as the wind utterly destroyed the building. But before Abner could lament his new loss, a woman shrieked, "The whaling boats are sinking." And she was correct, for in the roads the demonic wind, still with no rain, had whipped up a sea that the rugged whalers could not survive. The unfortunate ones were those who were torn loose from their anchorages and dashed across the roads to the island of Lanai, on whose steep and rocky shores no rescue was possible. In that manner, four ships and 70 men perished, and as they died, the Hawaiians of Lahaina mourned, "They are the sacrifices for the death of our Ali'inui." Therefore, the sailors whose ships capsized off Lahaina would also have perished at the feet of the fatalistic Hawaiians, had not Abner Hale limped among them shouting, "Save those poor men! Save them!" But the Hawaiians repeated, "They are sacrifices." Until in frenzy, Abner rushed up to one-eyed Kelolo, screaming above the storm, "Tell them, Kelolo, tell them Malama does not require sacrifices. Tell them she died a Christian." There was a moment's hesitation, during which the old man, weak from his vigil in the cave, looked out at the sickening sea. Then, throwing aside his tapa breechclout, he plunged into the waves and began fighting them for the bodies of sailors. Ashore, Abner organized rescue parties, which waded, tied together by ropes, onto the reef from which most of the water had been blown by the fantastic winds. At the end of each line, swimmers like Kelolo battled the turbulent waters to haul foundering sailors across the jagged reef's edge, delivering them into the hands of rescuers. Without the work of Kelolo and Abner, the loss of American sailors would have been not 70, but nearly 300. Toward the end of the struggle, Abner was limping about the reef, shouting encouragement, when he received from the hands of a swimmer the already dead body of a cabin boy. And he was overcome by the ceaseless tragedy of the sea, and he started to pray, "They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep." But his prayer was halted when he looked into the violent storm and saw that the swimmer who had handed him the boy was Kelolo, who was shouting to the other Hawaiians, "Pray to Kanaloa for strength." And Abner could see that the swimmers were praying. When the whistling wind subsided, Abner sat limply beneath the cocoa trees, watching Dr. Whipple treat the rescued sailors. And when the doctor came to him for a rest, Abner asked, "These things couldn't have had any connection with Malama's death, could they?" When Whipple made no reply, he continued, "John, you're a scientist." From the day Whipple left the mission, Abner had never again referred to him as brother. "How do you explain such a wind? No rain, coming not from the sea but from the mountains." Even while helping to rescue the whalers, Whipple had been perplexed by this problem and now suggested, "The mountains on the other side of our island must form a curious kind of funnel. I would judge there must be wide open valleys up which the trade winds rush. When they roll over the tops of the mountains, the entire volume is compressed into this one narrow valley leading down into Lahaina." "That wouldn't have anything to do with the death of Anali'i, would it?" Abner asked suspiciously. "No. We can explain the wind as it roars down this side of the mountain. We know that's a force of nature. But of course," he added slyly, "it's entirely possible that the wind on the other side of the mountain blows only when Anali'i dies." Shrugging his shoulders, he added, "And if that's the case, why, you have just about what Kelolo claims." Abner started to comment on this, but instead changed the subject. "Tell me, John, how did you feel at the very height of the storm when you were on the reef rescuing the sailors? Seeing the whalers that had so recently been tormenting us, well, seeing them destroyed by the Lord." Dr. Whipple turned to study his companion, staring at him in disbelief. But Abner continued, "Didn't you feel that it was something like, well, I thought it was like the Egyptians at the Red Sea?" Whipple got up, disgusted, and called his wife, who was tending wounded sailors. "I don't think the Ali'i sent the wind, and I don't think God sank the ships," he growled, and left. But he had not waited for Abner to develop the full meaning of his speculations, as they had matured on the coral reef. So Abner chased him and said, "What I wanted to ask, John, was this. At that moment of what I have called God's revenge for the cannonading, did you feel any actual sense of revenge against the sailors?" "No," Whipple said flatly. "All I thought was, I hope we can save the poor devils." "I thought the same thing," Abner said frankly, "and I was astonished at myself." "You're growing up," Whipple said sharply, and left. One unexpected benefit came from the whistling wind that leveled much of Lahaina in 1829. When the damage was cleared away, Kelolo for the third time helped Abner rebuild his church. But this time the kahunas refused even to argue where the door should be. They put it where it should have been in the first place, where the local gods ordained. And the famous stone church they built that year stood for more than a century. Now Lahaina, the most beautiful of all Hawaiian towns, prospered as the national capital. The business center of the kingdom was Honolulu, to be sure, for foreigners preferred living near their consulates. But the Ali'i had never liked Honolulu, finding it hot, cheerless, and commonplace. So that, even though it was true that the boy king and his regents had to spend more and more time there, he returned whenever possible to his true capital, Lahaina. And his women often remained in the cool grass houses under the ko trees, even when he was called to the larger city. Whaling vessels, their crews now better behaved, came to Lahaina in increasing numbers. 78 would come in 1831, 82 in 1833. And because each stayed for about 4 weeks in the spring and 4 in the autumn, there were sometimes many tall-masted ships in the roads. And since the famous whistling wind of Lahaina blew only about twice a century, they rested in security within the charmed pocket of islands. The important thing to Janders and Whipple was that every whaler who came into the roads paid them a fee for something or other. Did the ship need firewood? J&W had it. Salt pork? Dr. Whipple found out how to salt down island hogs. Salt itself? J&W had a monopoly on the fine salt evaporated from the sea in flat lava rock beds. Did a ship's captain insist upon fresh pork at sea? J&W could provide healthy live pigs and bundles of tea leaves for fodder on long trips. Sweet potatoes, oranges that had been introduced by Captain Cook, and fish dried by Dr. Whipple. J&W had them all. And if a ship required balls of Olona twine, strongest in the world, or even cables woven of it, J&W control that monopoly, too. It was John Whipple, however, who devised one of the simplest money-making schemes for the firm. When a whaler put in with an unwieldy amount of whale oil, not enough barrels to warrant sailing all the way home, but so many that there seemed no purpose in returning to the off-Japan banks, Whipple arranged for the captain to leave his entire cargo at Lahaina under the care of J&W, who, when they had assembled half a dozen such cargoes, would argue some New England captain into running the entire lot back to New Bedford. In this way, J&W made a profit on storing the barrels of oil, on shipping them, and on chartering the ship that did the work. It therefore seemed to Whipple that the next logical step ought to be for his firm to buy the odd lots of oil outright and to hold them on speculation. Accordingly, he proposed that J&W acquire its own ships and take over the whale oil business. But cautious Captain Janders, tugging at his red beard, was adamant. Only one way to make money in this world, he judged. My motto, own nothing, control everything. Own a batch of oil outright? Never, because then you worry about the market. Let someone else own it. We'll handle it, and we'll make the better profit. But to own a ship, that is real madness. I've watched the tribulations of ship owners. They have to trust a rascally captain, a worst mate, and a depraved crew. They've got to feed the lot, insure the vessel, live in anguish when there's a storm, and then share whatever profits there are with the crew. You bought the Thetis, Whipple argued. Sure, Janders agreed. I bought her, but did you see how fast I sold her? On an earlier trip, I had watched Kilolo's mouth watering for such a ship, and I knew I could turn a quick profit. Me operate a ship on my own responsibility? Never. And he pointed to the rotting hulk that still hung on the reef. Whenever you want to buy a ship, John, always remember the Thetis. Still, Whipple was not satisfied, for he argued, somebody makes money on ships. I thought it might as well be us. Janders agreed in part, for he said, I grant that properly handled, a ship can make a little money. But if you and I learn how to manage the business and the lands right here, John, we'll make a fortune that'll stagger the ship owners. Own nothing. Control everything. In the fields Captain Janders had determined to control, he was a master trader, sending meat to Oregon, picking up furs for Canton, sending hides to Valparaiso and tallow to California. He made a quick profit on each exchange and was always on hand when men were in trouble, for then money was free. Gradually, the whalers found that they could trust him with any transaction, and he became their agent. If a ship's captain wanted to risk the dying sandalwood trade, having heard that Captain Janders had made his fortune on it, J&W gladly accumulated the precious cargo and provided letters of introduction to the Canton merchants who would buy it. If another felt convinced that he could turn a handsome profit running fresh beef to Oregon, then ice to California, J&W would supply the live cattle, sending the crazy young cowboys of Lahaina up into the hills to lasso the wild animals that had been introduced into the islands by Captain Vancouver in 1794. To win the good wishes of the mariners, J&W also provided many free services. If a sailor wanted to marry a native girl, there was no point in applying to Reverend Hale to conduct the ceremony, for he frowned on such alliances and invariably spent at least an hour praying with the sailor and pointing out that God had long ago warned against the sin of whoring after the heathen. Dr. Whipple, however, had been given the right by Kilolo to solemnize such marriages, and many families who were destined to live in Hawaiian history, producing the powerful half-caste politicians who organized the islands, sprang from marriages which started in the J&W store, where Reverend Whipple used Amanda, Captain Janders, and his wife Luella as witnesses. Abner, of course, held that all participants in such marriages were living in whoredom, and he told them so. J&W also served as mail drop for the fleet, and sometimes musty letters would lie in their bins for years before sailors came rolling up the wooden stairs and along the porch, shouting, Any mail for me? The wiry wanderer would sit in one of the J&W chairs and read of family affairs that had transpired 40 months ago. Then he would ask John Whipple for a piece of paper, and the doctor would explain, "That building at the corner, it's a writing room for sailors, and if you ask for Mr. Cridland, he'll take care of everything." Frequently, ship captains would transmit from the distant whaling grounds requests to J&W for a half dozen replacements for their crews to be picked up when the ship reached Lahaina. Captain Janders knew that whalers preferred stout Hawaiian boys, and he provided them at $5 a head. But when none were available, he would visit Kailolo and tell the one-eyed, toothless police marshal, "Round up 8 or 10 deserters for next month." And Kailolo would move his men through the countryside, dragging in as worthless a lot of murderers, cowards, ship-jumpers, adulterers, and hopeless drunks as any nation of the day could have provided. No American deserter could be so degenerate or worthless but that some kind Hawaiian family would give him refuge. They even fought the police to keep the murderers from arrest. But when the rogues were finally lodged in jail, Mr. Cridland from the Seaman's Chapel would move among them, explaining, "If you're taken back to America in chains, you'll be tried and sent to jail. But if you volunteer, you'll not only get wages, but also escape trial." And with Ebner's help, usually in the form of long prayers with the dissolute rogues, Cridland would whip the men into reasonable shape, and as soon as the short-handed whaler hove into sight, Kailolo would release the imprisoned vagabonds, and Captain Janders would march them to the pier, where he would announce to the incoming captain, "A fine lot of men here for you to choose from." And on every such recruitment, J&W would make its small commission. Other letters of more personal content sometimes arrived, and one day in 1831, Captain Janders sent Whipple through Lahaina seeking the Hawaiian Pupali, for a letter awaited him from Valparaiso, and it appeared to contain a substantial sum of money. When Fat Pupali came to the store, Janders explained, "I no savvy, Pupali, one letter for you but." "Me no savvy read," Pupali grinned. "Okay, you listen for me, I speak for you dis paper," Janders said. "Alu, alu," Pupali nodded, his eyes bright with anticipation. When Janders opened the Valparaiso letter, a handful of British pound notes fluttered to the floor, and Pupali jumped upon them, pinning them down one after another, like a man swatting cockroaches. "Pahea dis money, it blong for me?" he grinned. "We'll see," Janders said, pressing out the thin paper on which the letter was written. "To my good friend Pupali of Lahaina," Janders began. "Well, at least the letter's for you. Now we'll see about the money," Janders announced. And Fat Pupali laughed at the large circle that had now gathered at the startling news that one of their men had received a document from Valparaiso. "Who is it from?" an onlooker asked. And Captain Janders carefully smoothed down and inspected the last few lines of the message. "It's from Captain Hawksworth," he said with some surprise. At the name of the feared whaler, some of the Hawaiians drew back, for the memory of Hawksworth's cannonading was still vivid in their memories. "What kind of talk he make?" Pupali asked. "I am sending you herewith, my long and trusted friend, the sum of 45 pounds sterling, which is a goodly sum of money, and which an English ship captain whom I bespoke off the Japan coast gave me as a present when I gave him your daughter Iliki. He was a fine-looking man and promised to treat her well, and said he would take her home with him to Bristol when his cruise was over. Since Bristol is on the other side of the world, you will probably not see Iliki again, but when I last saw her, she was happy and in good health. I could not bring her back to Lahaina, as I had made a full cargo off Japan and was sailing directly home, where a girl like Iliki would not be well received. Since I had to do something, it seemed to me better that I pass her along to a decent English captain than leave her in Valparaiso, where she would certainly get into trouble. I am sending you his entire gift, less 5 pounds which I gave Iliki for herself, because I think it good for a woman to have some money of her own in a strange country. I hope to see you again soon. Give my love to your wife and your other daughters. They are all good girls. Your trusted friend, Rafer Hawksworth. It was the island consensus that Captain Hawksworth had behaved rather well in this matter, for all who knew Valparaiso and New England agreed that a girl like Iliki would not have prospered in either locale. And while it seemed likely that the English captain would pass her along to some other ship when the time came for him to return to Bristol, there was always the chance that he might grow fond of the lively girl and take her with him. Lahaina believed implicitly that the gift had indeed been 50 English pounds, and that Captain Hawksworth had accounted honestly for all of it. His foresight in sequestering 5 pounds for the girl herself was widely praised, and carefree Pupali was suddenly looked upon as a wealthy man. But the transaction was forcefully condemned by Reverend Hale, who, as soon as he heard of it, hurried to J&W to satisfy himself that the letter was authentic. He then sought out Pupali and charged in Hawaiian, "You cannot keep that money, Pupali, for a father to profit from the sale of his own daughter would be infamous." "Is it a great kapu?" the fat Hawaiian asked, with his wife and 3 daughters at his elbows. "A kapu so horrible that there is no word for it," Abner explained. "But you just used a word for it," Pupali hopefully pointed out. "I used several words," Abner snapped. "What I mean is that civilized languages are not required to have a single word, because such an act..." He stopped in confusion and started over by stating flatly, "It is a horrible act, Pupali. You cannot keep that money." "What shall I do with it?" Pupali asked. "I think," Abner said after due reflection, "that you should turn it over to the church. Absolve yourself of the sin of which you are now a part." Pupali got the money, laid it out carefully, and studied it. Then he shook his head negatively. "No," he reasoned, "if this money is as kapu as you say, isn't it better that it harm only me and not something as fine as your church?"